thank you very much, and thank you a lot for this invitation. I'm very happy to present some of my work here today. And yeah, as you said, I want to talk a little bit about Lorentzian quantum gravity in asymptotically safe quantum gravity and about the graviton spectral function. So the overarching goal of this is to take a few steps towards unitarity in asymptotically safe quantum gravity. This is of course a very very ambitious goal and a very so I'm not going to get very far in the question of unitarity today, but this is the thing that we have in the back of our mind, that we want to be able to investigate certain things for time like momenta and so on. Before I get really started, let me give you a very, very short reminder about the failures of perturbative quantum gravity. And here I want to in particular emphasize in which way perturbative quantum gravity can fail, so that later on I can connect to these points. So of course you can start with Einstein-Hilbert gravity and quantize it, and you will quickly realize that the theory is perturbatively non-renormalizable. The first hint of you is given by the negative mass dimension of the Newton coupling in four dimensions, which in the end causes you to have in each order of the loop expansion higher order counter terms that you need to include in your action. This has then in the end been confirmed at two loop with the infamous Gorov sonority counter term. And then this is believed to give start to rise of infinitely many counter terms that you need to include. And in the end, this will lead to a non-predictive theory. Conversely, you can of course start with higher derivative gravity and also include terms like the Weyl squared and the Ricci squared in your action. This is now a perturbatively renormalizable quantum field theory, which you can infer, get a hint from the dimensionless couplings that you have now. But the problem is now that you have perturbatively a non-unitary theory. So this you can see from the graviton propagator. So the graviton propagator has now 1 over p squared from the Einstein-Hilbert term plus a 1 over p to the 4 from these higher derivative terms. And you can rewrite this in this way, where you see that you have now a massless graviton propagator plus a second massive graviton propagator with the wrong sign, which is now the massive ghost of higher derivative gravity. And so if you do perturbative quantum gravity, you either face a problem with predictivity or a problem with unitarity. And one contender of solving these problems is this asymptotically safe quantum gravity, which sticks to the things that the metric should carry the fundamental degrees of freedom, and that diffeomorphism symmetry should be the fundamental symmetry, but tries to fix this problem in a non-perturbative way. So this conjectures that the UV behavior is governed by an interacting fixed point, and this fixed point would allow you to non-perturbatively renormalize the theory. So here in the left, you can see a very early version of this setup, where you have done a non-perturbative quantization of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So here you have the dimensionless cosmological constant and the dimensionless Newton coupling. And indeed, in this setup, you find a non-perturbative interacting UV fixed point here, and you find G trajectories that then lead to the IR, where you can find classical general relativity. If you sit on one of these trajectories, then this implies that in the IR, the dimensionless Newton couplings scales as k squared and reaches the fixed point becomes constant, reaches a fixed point of Waffle-Planck scale. And conversely, the dimension full Newton coupling is constant in ER with the value that we know from nature and decays with k squared above the Planck scale. And of course, this is a very early picture, very simplified. But since then, many improvements have been done, and in the existence of the fixed point was shown in many, many more elaborate truncations. Now, how does this relate to the failures of perturbative quantum gravity that I've talked on the last slide? So we had predictivity and a unitarity. Well, the predictivity in this picture is related to the UV critical hypersurface. So the number of UV attractive directions at this fixed point. And this was investigated in many, many works. And if you ask most people at the moment, they would guess that there are around three, maybe four relevant directions in pure gravity at this fixed point. So we have seen first evidence that this theory is actually predictive. Now, the second question is, of course, unitarity, and that is actually a very often very criticized point about asymptotically safe gravity, because at this interacting fixed point, you have to include all the operators that are compatible with the symmetry of the theory, so all higher order derivative terms. And of course, then this raises the question, is this actually a unitary theory that you're computing? And this is, of course, a very difficult to answer question, and especially if I compare it to the predictivity, a much less explored one in the asymptotically safe community, because the question is so much harder. There have been first steps, but what was really lacking in taking steps towards unitarity is, in my opinion, to have a truly non-perturbative Lorentzian setup that allows you to also access time-like correlation functions at time-like momenta. So in some sense, that you are able to access properties of the spectral function and also the properties of higher order vertex function for time-like momenta. And this is what we wanted to do in this work. We wanted to set up a non-perturbative Lorentzian. I want to show you today a non-perturbative Lorentzian setup in asymptotically safe gravity. But before I go into asymptotically safe gravity, let me first give you a short reminder about the Chellin-Lehmann spectral representation. So if you have the spectral representation rho, then you can compute the propagator, which I call G, for all momenta for space-like and time-like momenta. And if you have the propagator, then from the time-like axis, from the branch cut on the time-like axis, you can compute the spectral representation. And if you have physical stable particle, then the expectation of this representation is that you have delta peak, where the mass of the particle is, and you have a multi-particle continuum, which starts at 2m squared. And if there are bound states, then these show up also as delta peaks in between the mass peak and the multi-particle continuum. And if it's a physical stable particle, you also expect that it's a positive definite spectral function, and then this is linked to the unitarity of the theory. Let me give you a bit of a more picture of the propagator in the complex plane. So if my propagator satisfies the Chellin-Lehmann spectral representation, then we have the picture here on the left-hand side, where the red cross here denotes the pole of the propagator. And here with these red circles, I'm denoting the branch cut. So here on the positive real axis, we have the time-like momenta. on a negative real axis, we have the space-like momenta. And in the spectral function, and conversely, this corresponds to the delta peak. And this branch cut corresponds to the multiparticle continuum. Here on the right-hand side, you would already see a generalization of the Chern-Lehmann representation. So this is already going beyond the Chern-Lehmann representation. In this case, we have a branch cut starting at zero and two complex conjugated poles in a complex plane. And in this case, these relations here would not hold anymore, and one would need to introduce a generalization of them. This is actually, to mention, this is actually a very widely discussed option, for example, in QCD, which stems from the fact that if you introduce a mass term by hand for the gluon, which is the so-called Cucci-Ferrari model, and then you do a perturbative computation, then you actually find that these complex conjugated poles show up, and people have speculated that this might also hold in a non-perturbative case, but of course, that is not known if it holds or if it does not hold. One thing that I want to emphasize is that usually if you have a non-perturbative method, such as the lattice or the FRG, this only provides you numerical data for space-like momenta, so on the negative half axis, and then for an analytic continuation to the whole complex plane, you need to make certain assumptions. You need to have a reconstruction problem. And for example, you need to make the assumption if you have a Chern-Lehmann representation or if you have a generalization of that. Okay, so that's the picture that we have in mind. So we want to find a branch cut on the time-like axis, and we want to find a real Euclidean propagator on the space-like axis. Let me give you a few examples before we go to asymptotic severity in what we know about the graviton spectral function. So if you have the Aichen-Hilbert action and you simply expand it about a flat Minkowski background, and then you look at the graviton two-point function at the propagator, you find that on shell, the propagator is just a 1 over p squared. And for the spectral representation means that there's a simple delta peak at vanishing frequencies, which corresponds obviously to the massless graviton as expected. Let me emphasize one thing in all these plots that I will show today. If this is now the propagator for space-like momenta, so this propagator is here on a negative half axis, and I have switched the signs for illustration purposes. Okay, so this is the classical graviton spectral function for the Aichen-Hilbert action. One can do the same thing for the higher derivative action, now including the Ricci squared and the Wild squared tensors. And now, as shown before, now the propagator has two terms, the massless one over the massless graviton, 1 over p squared, and the massive Planck scale graviton with the wrong sign. This, for the spectral function, corresponds to the delta peak at vanishing frequencies and a negative delta peak at Planck scale frequencies, which is then also related to the unitarity issue. So you can actually do more before you go full asymptotically safe gravity. You can also do effective field theory. So that's what I want to do next. So just compute the one loop effective action. There you find these terms, which are Ricci scalar, logarithm of box Ricci, and also Weyl, logarithm of box Weyl. And those give you a propagator, which has this p squared plus logarithm p squared times p to the 4 behavior. So in summary, this means that at small momenta, you have the P squared behavior, but you also have a subleading behavior. So when you subtract the 1 over P squared behavior, which is basically a logarithm in the IR. And on it for the delta, for the spectral function, this corresponds to the fact that you have a delta peak at vanishing frequencies, which is not shown here in the plot, which you have to imagine at vanishing frequencies. And then you have a constant spectral function roughly up to the Planck scale. And this is, if we do asymptotically safe Doherty, this is what we have to connect to below the Planck scale. We have to find the subleading logarithmic behavior, or rather a constant spectral function in the IR. Actually, I have swept two things under the carpet here when I'm telling you this. So first of all, I'm at the moment only talking about the transverse traceless mode of the graviton propagator and not about the other modes. So this is basically the scalar part of the transverse traceless tensor structure. And second of all, if I want to compute this, I have to do a gauge fixing. So I have to include a gauge fixing, which is of the following kind. So I have my gauge fixing condition F, which I've given you here. This is the standard, the Donda type gauge fixing. It's a two parameter family of alpha and beta. And the result depends on these gauge parameters, as you can see here. So here I've given you some examples of gauges that are commonly used in the literature. So alpha zero corresponding to Landau gauge, and here, for example, alpha one, beta one corresponding to the harmonic gauge. And what I want to emphasize here is that already, so first of all, the propagators and the spectral function are obviously gauge dependent. They're not a gauge invariant quantity. And second of all, we also have gauge parameters for which the spectral function is negative. So if you were hoping for a positive semi-definite spectral function, already with effective field theory, your hope is gone. And for this, I didn't even need to do asymptotically safe gravity. So this already shows you, and for questions of unitarity, it is of course not enough to just compute a gauge variant spectral functions of such as the graviton spectral function, but in the end, you need to construct gauge invariant objects and evaluate those for time-like momenta, for example. Okay, so this is what we know without doing asymptotically safe gravity. Now, actually, let me do asymptotically safe gravity, and let me first of all introduce the tool that we are kind of using today. So this is the functional normalization group, which basically provides you a non-perturbative renormalization group equation for the scale-dependent effective action. So the flow of the scale-dependent effective action is given by this object on the right-hand side, which is the scale-dependent propagator times a regulator contribution, a regulator insertion, which you can see here diagrammatically. So the idea is that that one integrates out fluctuations step by step. So it's implementing the Wilsonian renormalization group in a non-perturbative way. You start in the UV and at the UV fixed point, or if you have another theory, at the bare actioner, you integrate out momentum shell by momentum shell, and in the end, at k equals zero, you reach the full quantum effective action. The way this is implemented is via regulator, which sets you the scale at which the fluctuations are integrated out, but also takes care that the theory is UV regularized. So this is the standard tool with which most computations in asymptotically safe quantum gravity are done. So what is not the problem, but why is there, why can you not do Lorentzian computations in this standard setup? That's what I want to explain now. So the standard formulation, I mean, is based that you modify the dispersion of the propagator with this regulator term. This regulator term, as I said, implements the Wilsonian RG. But by implementing this Wilsonian RG, it actually inevitably introduces putts, poles and cuts in a complex plane. So let's assume you have, we have a standard, we have a simple P squared classical dispersion, and we modify it with a regulator term. You have, for example, show you a standard exponential regulator. And this, as you can see, it actually for each finite k, it introduces infinitely many poles in a complex plane. And therefore, this relation between the propagator and the Chalin-Lehmann representation at finite k is ruined. Only at k equals zero, when the regulator is fully removed, you can use this relation again. And in principle, then you have numerical data for space-like momenta. Then you could, and then you can attempt an analytic continuation under certain assumptions. For example, under the assumption that the graviton has a Chalin-Lehmann representation, and this we have done actually last year. And I will also mention a little bit of those results today. Yeah. So the problem in the FRG is that the regulator usually spoils the nice properties of the Chalin-Lehmann representation. So the new Lorentzian formulation that we are that we have implemented now is that we're using instead a Kalin-Simancic cutoff. So our regulator is now not momentum dependent, it's simply k squared. So it's an AG scale dependent mass term, which suppresses the R modes and therefore also implements the Wilsonian RG. So if I'm looking again at this picture where I have a classical P squared dispersion, now the shift by the regulator simply shifts the mass pole. And obviously this does not destroy the Chalin-Lehmann representation. And you can use this relation even at finite k. So what's the catch? What price do we pay? And if you're familiar with the FRG, you have immediately spotted, of course, the problem with this. This regulator does not regularize the UV. So the flow that we are obtaining with this regulator is not UV finite, as it is usually in the FRG. It does not suppress UV modes. And the price that we have to pay is that we have to additionally regularize the UV divergence, the divergences that are not captured by this regulator. So now, and this we do with standard dimensional regularization in 4 minus epsilon dimensions. So the FRG equation that we had before has now an additional term, which encompasses the counter terms, which makes this now finite. So in some sense, we have a double regularization of our theory. We have a cutoff regularization, which implements the Wilsonian RG. And additionally, at each RG step, we have a dimensional regularization. So now, compared to standard perturbation theory, these counter terms are RG scale dependent and build up while we integrate out our flow. As all other quantities also build up as we integrate our flow, like the propagator or the spectral function. I want to emphasize one more thing. So this choice of a Kalin-Simancic cutoff is of course not unique. So alternatively, one could have, for example, introduced a regulator with a spatial momentum cutoff. So as long as you don't affect the temporal component, this does not ruin the Gaussian symmetric vector representation. So you only need to stay away from the temporal component. But of course, if you have a spatial cutoff, this breaks Lorentz symmetry, and which is then restored at k equals zero. But at finite k, you have to be aware that Lorentz symmetry is broken. But this would have the advantage that the flows are then conversely finite, and this term would not be there. And in otherwise, actually, this flow equation emerges from the regulator with spatial momentum cutoff in the limit where you remove the spatial part of the regulator. So, but in any case, this is the new trick that we're introducing. We have a double regularization with the Kern-Simonsky cutoff that leaves the Chern-Lehmann representation invariant at finite k. All right, what is the concrete setup that we are looking at? So we are looking at the Einstein-Hilbert action, which we expand about a flat Minkowski background. And we want to compute directly the flow of the graviton spectral function, which we then, via the Chern-Lehmann representation, obtain from the flow of the graviton two-point function. The flow of the graviton two-point function is given by these diagrammatics. So we have two diagrams from the graviton loops. So double lines represent gravitons. And this dotted line is the ghost contribution. And then here in the end, we have the counterterm contribution, which makes these diagrams finite. If you look at one diagram schematically, now all the propagators are replaced by the Chern-Lehmann representation. So we have three propagators / Chern-Lehmann spectral functions in here. And then we have the dimensionally regularized loop integral, which we evaluate, as I said, in 4 minus epsilon dimensions. This term here just encompasses all the terms from the contraction. And then in the end, what we have to solve is, in some sense, one loop diagram of massive particles, where the spectral value here is basically like a mass term in these dimensionally regularized integrals. Let me also emphasize that this tadpole contribution is actually identically vanishing, as it is usual for dimensional regularization. Okay, so we compute the flow of the graviton spectral function, which is parameterized in the following way. So we have a delta peak at this mass parameter. This mass parameter has one contribution which stems from the regulator itself, k squared, plus a term which is related to the cosmological constant, which is this graviton mass parameter mu. Then we have an ensuing multi-graviton continuum, which starts as at 4 mh squared, and this is the multi-graviton continuum. In front, we have the graviton wave function normalization, and usually the graviton wave function normalization is momentum dependent, and I want to emphasize that here it is evaluated on the mass shell of the, so on the pole of the propagator. And now, for example, if I look at this complicated integral and we evaluate this only for the delta terms and we remove the divergent parts, then we in the end actually obtain a rather simple solution for these integrals with this characteristic Alk-Kosh contribution. And from this, we can in the end obtain flow equations for the graviton mass parameter, the multi-graviton continuum, and as well for the on-shell bifunction normalization. Let me emphasize that we compute all these, but actually we make the additional approximation of neglecting the feedback on the right-hand side from this multiparticle continuum, which is a higher order contribution. We also do not compute the flow of the Newton coupling. This is actually taken from previous works from computation of the free Brayton vertex at p equals zero. So it's not yet a fully Lorentzian setup, but at least the Brayton spectral function, the Brayton two-point function, is computed in a Lorentzian setup. Okay, in the setup, we find a graviton, we find a UV fixed point and critical exponents, which are actually very similar to those of Euclidean studies. And from these, from this UV fixed point, we can run towards the AR, and we run to the AR with the boundary conditions that the Newton coupling should have the value that should have the known measured value, and the cosmological constant that we want to reach in the AR is actually vanishing. So we want to have a vanishing cosmological constant, which makes sense since we're expanding about a flat Minkowski background, and the vanishing cosmological constant is then the corresponding on-shell solution. And as you can see here in this plot, the Greuter mass parameter and the Newton coupling, they increase with k squared below the Planck scale, while they become constant above the Planck scale. And the Greuter wave function normalization decays with this asymptotically safe scaling in the UV, but it becomes a constant in the IR. The value actually of this wave function normalization is in the IR is arbitrary and just sets an overall scale of the graviton spectral function. On this trajectory, we integrate the multi-graviton continuum and therefore compute the graviton spectral function. And this is what we find. So the spectral function has a massless graviton delta peak, which is not shown in the plot, but it's at vanishing frequencies. We find the constant part that matches the effective field theory expectation. We find a dip around the Planck scale, and then above the Planck scale, the spectral function decays with this asymptotically safe scaling. Here on the right-hand side, I show you the propagator for space-like momentum. The leading behavior in AR is the expected p squared with the sub-leading logarithm of p squared behavior as expected from effective field theory and a constant part here in the spectral function. And in the UV, it decays with the expected, it decays with an asymptotically safe scaling. And actually this result is very well compatible qualitatively with previous results, with the previous result from the analytic continuation from Euclidean results. I'm actually not showing the exact comparison because those computations were done in different gauges. And as you've seen before, these computations are very gauge dependent, so it would not be a fair comparison. But qualitatively, the agreement is rather good. And since we have the graviton spectral function, we can actually compute the graviton propagator in the full complex plane. Let me note that now I'm not plotting it as a function of p squared, so, but this is the real and the imaginary part of the temporal component of the propagator. And I've subtracted in both plots the 1 over p squared behavior. Here on the left plot, you see the real part, and in the right-hand side, you see the imaginary part. Since I'm now showing you the temporal component, the dashed line indicates the time-like axis with the branch cut, the expected branch cut. And here would be then the space-like axis. And here you could, for example, see that on the space-like axis, the imaginary part is exactly vanishing. And here on the space-like axis, you would exactly find the propagator for space-like momenta that I've shown you here in this plot. So this is how you have to read this plot. And now one very important information is actually, so what about complex structures? What about structures in the complex plane, additional complex structures? So the flow respects the Chell and Lehmann representation. That is the very important information here. So the flow does not generate complex conjugated poles or complex conjugated branch cuts in the propagator. So in some sense, we start with the Chern-Lehmann representation, and it is preserved along the flow. And this is actually a highly non-trivial statement. So for example, if you would do the same computation in QCD, then the flow would not respect the Chern-Lehmann representation, and you would find that complex conjugated poles or branch cuts start to appear. But within our truncation, this can, of course, change at higher truncations, but within our truncations, this was not the case, and the Chern-Lehmann representation was preserved. So so for me, this was one of the big positive results in this context. So, and this is also the main result that I want to present today. Let me give you a short thing about a short simpler approximation that we also did. So we have used the Greyton coupling from the free, we have computed the Newton coupling from the free graviton vertex expansion momenta, but we have also studied now the setup with a simpler trajectory for Newton's couplings, which is really a simple trajectory which should mimic the flow of the Newton coupling, and we have neglected the ghosts. Why have we done this? Because now we can actually solve the flow of the graviton wave function realization and the flow of the graviton mass parameter fully analytically. So the trajectories are now what I show here, and that is of course very nice. So why can we actually solve this analytically? Is usually you have threshold effects in the FRG computation, like 1/1 mu, and these disappear now because our flow is an on-shell quantity. And this makes it easier to solve these equations. And all these coefficients that I show you below here, they are principally known analytically, but here I just give you a numerical value. And what you can see here is that the wave functionalization, it has goes to one in the IR. It has it changes the behavior around the Planck scale. So this basically sets the scale where the behavior is changing, and then above that, it has this characteristic asymptotically safe scaling. And the graviton mass parameter has its, in UV, it goes to its fixed point value. In the IR, it goes to the cosmological constant that we want, where we want it to go. So this we can choose. And then again, it has this turnaround behavior around the Planck scale, which switches between IR and UV behavior. And with this analytic approximation, we can now also study the spectral function for finite cosmological constants. So in the blue line is again the spectral function for vanishing cosmological constant. It's slightly different than the one before because we have now the simplified Newton coupling and also neglected the ghost. And as you see, the only thing that changed is basically that this dip disappeared, which makes sense. We have made a simple approximation. So some structure from the spectral function has disappeared. And then conversely, with positive and negative cosmological constant, we see that a negative cosmological constant basically acts like a mass term. So now also that the delta function is not at vanishing frequencies anymore. We have in the multi graviton continuum sets on at a finite scale. While the for positive cosmological constant, it basically enhances the spectral function above here. And of course, this is not should not be taken at bare value because this is now an off-shell computation. We are still expanding around a flat Minkowski background, and the on-shell solution is the vanishing cosmological constant. And so these spectral functions could be used in a subsequent computation, but one needs to account that this is now an off-shell spectral function. And if you would, for example, do the same computation with a de Sitter or an anti-de Sitter background, then you should, of course, reobtain that the graviton spectral function has a mass peak at vanishing frequencies, and so on. Okay. What have we learned about unitarity? Because that was the goal that I started with, and that's what we wanted to maybe get a small foothold in. And of course, this goal is still very far away. As I said in the beginning, it's a complicated question, and we cannot get very far with it. So now I believe we have done a first step. We have set up a non-perturbative Lorentzian way of treating asymptotically safe gravity and computed the graviton spectral function. So, and with this, I hope that a little further down the road, we can actually compute scattering processes for time-like momenta, or eventually also bound state operators, gauge invariant bound state operators, such as gravity balls maybe, or metagravity bound states, or maybe even some kind of black hole operator, and set up spectral function for those kind of states. And I hope that with this further down the road, we eventually get a small foothold at the very difficult question of unitarity in asymptotically safe gravity. So it's still a long way to go, but I believe that we have done maybe a first important step by setting up this Lorentzian way of computing correlation functions. And yeah, with this, I'm coming to my summary. I hope I convinced you that we were able to set up a Lorentzian way of computing correlation functions, and I've shown you the first direct computation of a graviton spectral function, which turned out to have a massless graviton delta peak with a positive multigraviton continuum. And importantly, the flow respects the Chern-Lehmann representations, and no additional cuts or poles in the complex plane are created. And yeah, I hope that I could convince you that this is a key step towards scattering processes and unitarity in asymptotically safe gravity. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Manuel, for the great talk. Okay, are there questions? Ding.
Hi, thanks for the nice talk. I have a bit maybe stupid question. I'm not an expert of FRG. I wonder, you mentioned several times your calculation depends on a flat Minkowski background. Could you elaborate how your results depend on this choice of background?
It's a So, I mean, in principle, if you do a full computation, then it should not depend on the background. So you have a background independence, but in a truncation, of course, the choice of a background will show up. And as for example here, you know that the graviton is massless, has a massless delta peak, and so on, but this is spoiled here because of the mismatch of a finite cosmological constant and the choice of background. maybe to answer, why do we choose a flat Minkowski background? This is technically the most easiest choice because it directly allows you to go to momentum space. And with other more general backgrounds, this would be far more complicated. But in the end, the choice of background should not matter if you compute actually observables which are background independent.
Thank you. Could you pinpoint at which step the assumption comes in your calculation? At which step in the mathematical expressions do you assume a Minkowski background?
We start from the Einstein-Hilbert action, compute the vertices, and here we split the full metric with the Minkowski background in the fluctuation. And now we are truncating our setup at a finite order of these fluctuations. And that's basically where then the assumption of a flat Minkowski background kicks in. So, and then the graviton propagator and the spectral functions are the quadratic part of this fluctuation H, which is of course then depends on which background you have chosen.
Are you assuming H is small, so you ignore higher order terms in H? Is that correct?
So in general, H does not need to be small. But of course, I'm making an expansion in H, and the question is, of course, then how well it will converge within this expansion.
I guess if you don't assume H is small and you integrate over all values of H, then it doesn't seem to me it should depend on the background.
Yes, so yeah, exactly. So in the end, if you do not truncate it, it will the answer will not depend on the background, yes. But since we work in truncations, it will show up.
By truncation, you mean the order of H?
Yeah, the approximation that we're working in. Yeah.
I see. Thank you.
So we are only including correlation functions up to H to the 3 at the moment.
Thank you.
More questions?
Benjamin. Yeah, hi, Manu. Thanks for this really nice talk. I really enjoyed it. Also reading the papers, obviously. I have a couple of questions, so Alessi, you should stop me at some point. Maybe the first one that really puzzled me. You said that the flow preserves the Chain-Lehmann representation. That surprised me, actually. In standard perturbation theory, you would get these polylogs, I guess, at higher loop orders, which might introduce new branch cuts. So you don't see them, I guess? Or?
What do you mean by that?
So you said that in QCD, you get new branch cuts, new complex poles. Do you have any understanding why this is not the case in gravity? Maybe is it because you neglected the feedback of the spectral function on the right-hand side?
So I can't answer you that question yet. This is still work in progress. I mean, we are looking into it, why this is happening. And of course, we are also working on including the feedback of the multi-graviton continuum on the right-hand side. But I cannot tell you yet. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. Then maybe a related question. Exactly on the slide, you make an ansatz for the spectral function that it's a delta peak, a single delta peak, and the particle continuum. So you don't put complex poles in by hand. Is that a strong assumption or?
This assumption is supported by the flow, actually. I mean, we make this assumption because this is how the flow generates it. I mean, we start out obviously with the delta peak. The delta peak is there from the classical Einstein-Hilbert action, and this thing is immediately generated. If something else would be generated, we would also include it in the ansatz.
Okay, so it's not really an assumption that goes in there.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Perfect. Yeah great. One question to the one loop spectral function. You said that it's quite gauge dependent and also showed it. is that because the one loop coefficients of the logs are gauge dependent, or where does it come from?
Yeah, that's exactly the place where it comes from.
Good. Let me skip those, but the obvious question is when you include the three-point function.
Well, I think it's technically possible. At the moment, we are first of all looking at including the feedback. Mm-hmm. And I also want to look at the other graviton mode, because the scalar mode might also be very interesting.
Absolutely.
And then let's see when the three-point function comes.
But related to that question, is there something like a Chern-Lehmann representation for the higher endpoint functions? Is that known, or how does it look like?
It's not the Chern-Lehmann representation, but you can have some spectral-like representation for higher endpoint function. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't know off the top of my head how it looks like.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Next is Bianca.
Hi. So you consider the flow for the spectral function in the Lorentzian. Can you also consider directly the flow for the effective action in the Lorentzian?
In some sense, you can convert those quantity into each other. Not fully, because of course we have made an expansion, and we would now need to map it back to terms in the effective action. But in principle, those are of course related to each other and can be mapped into each other.
Okay, thanks.
Does it answer the question, or?
Well, I assume you chose the spectral function because you want to answer more directly questions about unitarity. But I'm kind of asking whether you could directly do asymptotic safety more with a Lorentzian and a Lorentzian setup.
Yeah, yes. The answer is yes. I can express the spectral function as terms in the scale dependent effective action, and in some sense write the spectral functions in terms of these kinds of operators, like a Ricci scalar function of box Ricci scalar, and therefore convert then the spectral functions as terms in the effective action. So it is a flow in the effective action in the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mark?
Yeah, hi, Manuel. Thanks for the nice talk. So my question is about the introduction of the counter terms from dimensional regularization. So I'm not sure I quite understood. So do you introduce the counter terms of the one loop counter terms of your seed action, or which ones do you introduce? And then also, I assume that they then come with a free parameter, just like in perturbation theory. And how is that parameter determined? And how is the number of counter terms restricted to be finite?
Yeah. Okay. So the counter terms. In the end, we are computing this these integrals, and this is a divergent integral. So if I take epsilon to zero, it is divergent. And so this one of epsilon term is precisely what I need to include in this counter term action. And then I have a finite part, which I can choose as I like. And this is in some sense corresponds into my renormalization condition. Compared to standard perturbation theory, the degree of divergence of these diagrams is actually lower because of the additional propagator that we have. So we have one more propagator, which lowers the degree of divergence. So instead of having a logarithmic, a quadratic, and a quartic divergence, we now only have a logarithmic and a quadratic divergence in this, in these diagrams. And yeah, so this of course also corresponds to a free parameter. And in the end, for the higher endpoint function, this also needs to be related to each other in order to not to still preserve predictivity of the theory.
Okay, but so I mean, what do you mean it has to be related? So I mean, if I computed the flow for higher endpoint functions, I would also have to introduce counterterms for these integrals, right?
Exactly. And if you for each order you would have to introduce a new counterterm, then of course this doesn't this would not be a finite thing.
Yes.
I mean, in the end, in the end, you have one flow equation, and this is one counterterm action, and this should have finitely many parameters.
Okay.
But we determine them from the two-point function.
Okay. Thank you.
Next is Nosrat.
Thank you for the talk. I have a question about the propagator. You have a fourth order modification to your propagator in the slides, very soon slides in the beginning of the slides.
You mean here?
Yeah. Fourth order modification, maybe it's one slide before. And before this, you have fourth order modification to your propagator. Yeah, here. Yeah. And is it possible to have the cubic modification here instead of four? You can use three.
Yeah, of course you can also have higher order interactions. Yeah, and then you have
order. Excuse me for interrupting. In the first order inverse of the Planck mass, p cubic on the m Planck instead of p four on square of the Planck mass, you can have p cubic on the p3 on Planck mass.
P to the 3. No, there's no p to the 3 term, which is compatible with the symmetries of the theory.
It produces some imaginary part in the potential, yeah? For example, if you compute the effective potential for your propagator, the answer will be a Yukawa-like potential in the massive graviton. And if you have the cubic term, then you have imaginary potential for the graviton.
Okay.
And I'm wondering about the interpretation of the imaginary part for the cubic term. We have for the fourth your correction the same result, we call it light. But for the cubic term, I'm wondering about that. This is my question. Maybe it's not so related to your talk.
I was not aware of that possibility, so I'm afraid I can't say much about that.
Thank you so much.
Are there other questions? Let me also ask a couple of questions. Yeah. Oh no, there is Lee first. Okay, Lee, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll be quick. Supposing that the hypothesis of dimensional reduction is a physical hypothesis and we accept it. So you would be expanding not around Minkowski space-time, but around some stochastic or quantum space-time background where epsilon, where the degree of divergence was 3 rather than 4 at short distances. But at any rate, epsilon was greater than 0. You could have a fractal distribution of obstacles to the graviton propagating, such that epsilon would be a finite number, and there would be no pole to cancel. Would you accept that as a possible hypothesis?
I guess so, yeah. That would be, of course, a very different setup, mm-hmm. but certainly an interesting one, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and so let me also ask a couple of questions. So one was regarding the figure that you have shown in the slide 15. So I wanted to ask you, like, why exactly there is that peak that separates the two regime, the effective field theory regime from the asymptotically safe scaling?
Yeah, this basically directly relates to the peak in the Newton coupling. And this directly comes from the fact that the critical exponents are complex conjugated, and you have the curling around the fixed point. So if you would go assume that you can't have critical complex conjugated exponents, then you might not find a dip in the spectral function, and also not the dip in the Newton coupling. And if I go to the analytic approximation, it's also precisely why there's no dip here, because you don't have complex conjugated curricular exponents.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And another question. So in your setup that starts from the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, you do not find the complex conjugate poles, but you say that in principle you should also analyze other starting points or higher order truncations. So would you expect that there is the possibility to then gain the complex conjugate poles, or do you have any argument why this should not happen?
No, I don't have any argument. It is unfortunately can only be investigated on in a case-to-case basis. As I said, in QCD, complex conjugate poles show up, and we do not yet understand the reason why this happens in one case and doesn't happen in the other. And yes, with another starting point, maybe this certainly can happen.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Okay, I don't see other questions. And in this case, I would ask you all to unmute yourself and thank Manuel.